You're listening to the COVID-19 Update, a podcast from the CSIS Global Health Policy Center focused on the science and policy implications of the outbreak. I'm Andrew Schwartz of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I'm joined by my colleague, Steve Morrison, to discuss the latest on COVID-19.
Today, we're delighted to be joined by Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis. He is currently serving since early August as the White House National Monkeypox Response Deputy Coordinator, along with Robert Fenton, the FEMA Regional Administrator, who is the White House Coordinator. The two of them took on these duties in early August, and we'll hear more in a moment. Dimitri, thank you so much for taking time out of your crazy schedule to share some thoughts with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to our conversation.
So, a couple of quick things. This is the 150th episode, Dimitri, of our podcast, which we started this series in February of 2020. We never thought we'd be doing such a thing, continuing it, carrying it forward at almost the three-year mark and at 150 episodes. So, you've landed on the 150th today. A few words about you. You served as director of the CDC Division of HIV Prevention. You're a widely recognized national expert on health issues that affect the LGBTQIA community. You've served earlier in New York City in the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene in the management of infectious diseases, and no less important as the incident commander for COVID-19 during what was really a monumental crisis in New York City. Thank you, Dimitri, for coming forward to share time with us today. Let's start. You've been on the job, this current posting, since early August. Give us a quick summary of where things stand in controlling the monkeypox outbreak in the United States. Give us a quick overview, please.
Sure. So we are at just over 23,000 cases, but we are seeing some really good signs of deceleration of the outbreak. It is not consistent throughout the country. There are certain parts of the country that are seeing a faster deceleration, while others are stable or potentially still increasing. So again, cause for cautious optimism is that we're seeing a deceleration. I think importantly, there are still pretty significant inequities. We see that the majority of cases are among Black and Latino individuals, and that inequity is increasing despite the decreases of cases. But as one of my mentors said a long time ago, getting to zero is the best way to address equity. So if we actually are able to control this, I think it's going to really be important that we control for all populations and not just one or two. So that's where we are. I think from the perspective of other things that aren't just the case count, we're seeing significant evidence in a couple of different studies that people have made behavior changes to decrease their risk of transmitting or acquiring monkeypox. So we're seeing, especially among gay, bisexual, other men who have sex with men, and transgender individuals, the folks have made changes in their behaviors. There are a couple of different studies, but the number tends to be about the same, about 50%. Have taken on sort of efforts to mitigate their risk. We're seeing more vaccine availability in the US. We're seeing studies opening for treatment and for vaccine. Also really hopeful signs of communication. So a recent study really showing that people's awareness about monkeypox vaccine, and willingness to take vaccine seems to be increasing between July and now. So again, cause for cautious optimism, multiple domains moving in a direction that look good, and really our eyes are really focused on our cases as well as our equity from the perspective of vaccine distribution.
Thanks so much, Dimitri. Andrew, over to you.
Thank you, Steve. Dimitri, you know, you just pointed to the communications of this. With the stigmas around COVID, then the stigmas around monkeypox, how has the communication strategy been more effective in this case?
I think one of the reasons is that we are working with a community that has really had their relationship tempered with fire with public health because of HIV. And I think that that is sort of a strength that comes in both directions. So public health, I think governmental public health knows the community, and the community is really willing to listen to public health. So I think that I'm taking that page out of the HIV playbook, really focusing on harm reduction from the very, very beginning of this, and going forward with communication around safer sex and mitigation strategies before we had enough data to do that with a lot of confidence, I think was important. And also the importance of risk communication, of saying what you know today may not be what you know tomorrow, but really, you know, saying at this point, this is what we think you need to do to change your behaviors to prevent a transmission or acquisition of this virus. We get more data, we change the guidance just to make sure that people are up to date. So I think it's practice makes perfect. I think that that since we're dealing with a very sort of specific community, we really pulled from that experience and pulled from it quickly.
So I get that on HIV, but were there also lessons that the governments learned from COVID that you were able to apply to the outreach in this regard?
Absolutely. So governmental public health can only set an example. Ultimately, the way that the information is transmitted is through trusted messengers. And so I think that that was really a clear lesson from COVID that was implemented here fairly quickly. I'll say that that lesson is also from HIV, but I think that it's fresher in our minds from COVID. So putting out language that is understandable and then making sure that the people that folks actually listen to, because it's not always governmental public health, are transmitting that information in a way that's understandable to their population.
Can you say a bit more about scaling the vaccines? I mean, we, as I understand it, so far about 600,000 vaccines administered. We've got a core population, 1.6 million living with HIV, correct? That are a very acutely vulnerable population. You have a few other targeted very acutely vulnerable. You have a larger LGBTQ population of 16 million or so that is seen as a priority. And then you have the scarcity of vaccines, the ramp up production, and then moving towards splitting doses in a variety of ways and applying them in a different fashion. Say a bit, these are complex, obviously operationally complex issues of amping up production and then figuring out how to break doses and administer them in a different fashion. Where does that all stand?
So first, as of September 13th, there were 540,000 doses that were administered to folks in the U.S. And the denominator for that is actually gay, bisexual, other men who have sex with men living with HIV, as well as those who have indications for PrEP. So that's sort of how the denominator of 1.6 or 1.7 million is calculated. So really, again, vaccine supply is really about a multi-domain strategy to increase supply. So the first is really production. So we've been working with the company in Denmark, Bavarian Nordic, to increase production, and we're seeing vaccine flowing from them in that direction. We've also contracted with a domestic company to do fill and finish, which means getting vaccine into a vial so it can actually be administered. We have also done that. And then lastly, the FDA emergency use authorization from August 9th that describes the intradermal strategy for administering vaccines. So it's really looking to the one vial as multiple doses. And in most people's hands, it's about four doses. It's not quite five. But all of those come together to really give us a switch in what happened from the perspective of the scarcity model that we were working with at the beginning of the outbreak. And, you know, I think challenging things are challenging. And I think as this outbreak has unfolded, there's been a lot of pivots. So this is not your standard monkeypox outbreak. It's not a zoonosis going to people with not efficient person-to-person transmission. It's very efficient, pretty efficient person-to-person transmission for certain populations, depending on the exposure. So again, gay, bisexual, other men who have sex with men. What's happening now is that we've transitioned from having scarce vaccine to having really a pipeline of vaccine that's coming, and also now the challenge of demand. We've already done the early adopters. So those folks all lined up and got vaccine really quickly. And I think now we're in the harder part of this outbreak, where we're focusing on folks who may not necessarily have sort of the same enthusiasm around the vaccine, or may not have the same level of access that's necessary to be able to get the vaccine. So it really reminds us that vaccination efforts aren't just about supply, but also about demand.
So what's the biggest challenge right now? Is it that the administration's request to Congress for $4.5 billion in emergency funding may not be successful? What are some of the biggest challenges?
Well, first I'll go back. Vaccine demand is going to be one of our biggest challenges. That's really about generating, you know, that interest that we need for populations who are overrepresented in the outbreak, but underrepresented in vaccines. So I'll start with that one is, I think, for me, the biggest challenge that we have. From the funding landscape, I think we've really been creative with colleagues throughout agencies. Probably the most important thing that's happened with current funding is that the CDC put out guidance to its grantees that allows monkeypox work to be supported by staff as well as funds from HIV and STD funding opportunities, both for health departments as well as for community-based organizations. So it sort of does put monkeypox into the context of where it lives. It is not an infection that lives in isolation. 61% of the people in one MMWR who were diagnosed with monkeypox were also diagnosed with either HIV, either had HIV or another STI in the 12 months prior. So this sort of signal is a syndemic signal, which I think is really important, that says, you know, put monkeypox in a context and support it using the resources that reach populations. So putting my HIV hat on, the people that I want to get monkeypox vaccine to are the same people I want to start on PrEP and get tested for HIV. So it's this very commonsensical moment, but one that in effect has been decades in the making to be able to get to the point where such a guidance can come out. In terms of the supplemental request, critically important for us, just looking at monkeypox, this is not, the easy part's done in terms of vaccination. We're now into the harder part, and that requires support. So for each person that we're going to get vaccinated, it's more effort, more money, more work to be able to do it. And so that supplement is going to be important to us, and also, you know, allows us to sort of build a strategy in the U.S. to make sure that we are addressing the gaps that we're seeing. So making sure that folks have access to testing if they're uninsured, making sure that we have supply to continue vaccination, as well as to replenish the strategic national stockpile, really focusing on important areas of research, making sure the regulatory components of this are clean and clear so that we can have it move quickly and efficiently. So that's really important. And the supplement's not about tomorrow. It's about making sure that we continue what we're doing today to get us to tomorrow.
And are you seeing mayors around the country weighing in with Congress, both Republicans and Dems, about, you know, this is an urgent matter. We really need to move this money. If we don't have this money, there will be very significant consequences to the ability to control the outbreak. I mean,
I can't speak to with full visibility who's reached out to Congress, but I know that in my outreach to jurisdictions, we're hearing a lot of enthusiasm around the need for that funding. I think it's pretty clear that the word that comes up a lot is exhaustion. And not only exhaustion of humans, but exhaustion of resources. I mean, there are examples of certain STD clinics that go through tens of thousands of dollars per month to be able to do the monkeypox work, and they don't have sort of additional support beyond the more now creative strategy of a permission to use HIV STD funds specifically. So I think it becomes really critical for us to have that. And I know, based on the jurisdiction outreach that I've had, that we're hearing a lot of folks who are saying, yeah, we really need to make sure Congress hears loud and clearly that these resources are critically important.
This comes on the heels of repeated impasse around getting passage of emergency funds for COVID, very much along partisan lines, even though, you know, the massive prior emergency supplementals were with strong bipartisan support, but we're in a different moment right now. How do you market this on a bipartisan basis here?
I'm going to stay with optimism, that I think that as we sort of tell the story of what we're seeing and what our future can be, our bipartisan support becomes critical. And that advocacy that we're hearing from jurisdictions who are experiencing this firsthand becomes really important, because ultimately, you know, this health issue is one that I think transcends party. But I think, again, hearing from the folks at the front line, expressing the exhaustion of resources as well as financial and human is pivotal for us to be able to make the point that these resources are the way that we're going to bridge ourselves to a really high level of control of this outbreak.
You know, this also gets to the sort of history and legacy of the HIV movement in the United States, which, you know, is a very impressive movement with very strong leadership, levels of organization, health-seeking behaviors, and has enjoyed over the years acquired a credibility and support across political lines. So it seems to me that you do have intrinsic advantages over time in making the case. You say a bit about that. You know this community as well as anyone in the country.
I do. I always say these are my people. So I think that very often from the perspective of advocacy, the lines between governmental public health and advocacy and HIV are not drawn as clearly as they necessarily are in other infections. Like, we work together as a unit. And I think that that's sort of what the success is of HIV advocacy and how they interact with government. And I think, again, that relationship has been forged by fire because of some really significant challenges in the early days of HIV. And so it is clear that we are leveraging that and they're leveraging us. And that's, I think, really where we are. And so I think that those voices are important. And also the voices of folks who are, again, jurisdictionally, other government, local government, and the way that they interact with their HIV sort of activist community, I think is really making it clear that this is really less about party, but more about like the health of Americans.
So is that the way you're approaching trying to secure bipartisan support for this? Or we have to point out there is some bipartisan discontent at this time.
It's there. And I think all we can do to be effective is to sort of show the data and show the story and make sure that we have the voices of people, both from local government as well as from the advocacy world, making the case for the need for this support. So, you know, I think ultimately, you know, it's hard to read people's minds. But I think that what we do know is that showing data, showing progress, and again, being transparent with the challenges. I mean, like this, the supplement actually addresses things that we can't fix right now. And we need to fix it to be able to move forward and fully control this outbreak. And I think that message needs to be loud and clear.
We had the Senate Help Committee hearing last week. I was reading over transcripts and press reporting on this, and it was very striking how strong the criticisms and feelings are on both sides of the aisle, the dissatisfaction and the dismay with the administration's performance on monkeypox. And I wanted you to comment on this because it seems to me that a couple of things are happening. One is you and Robert Fenton and all of your partners have jumped onto this, and you've begun a very significant turnaround, and you deserve a lot of kudos for that. And the methods and the logic that you've put forward make a lot of sense. But we still have a political problem, which is a great dissatisfaction and frustration and anger on both sides of the aisle about this. So how's that going to be overcome, do you feel, Dimitri?
It's a great question. I go back to my statement, it's about facts. And I think that the best we can do is sort of be clear about facts. I've worked in a lot of emergency responses, pretty big ones too. And the thing about this is that, you know, there's no such thing as moving fast enough in an emergency, but the lessons from COVID actually stuck with monkeypox. So I feel like, you know, there's been criticism about the speed the tests were commercialized. I've never seen anything faster in my career. That from, you know, case happened, 1 week later, CDC was on the phone with the lab organizations, and about a month later, we had a commercialized lab test. That's pretty fast. I think that the reality of the challenges of vaccine, they were real. But when faced with a challenge, coming up with plans and strategies that show movement in the right direction and really addressing a scarcity issue to the point where I can say to you, we don't have a scarcity issue anymore, is pretty remarkable. I think one of the hard parts of governmental public health is that we often don't tell our stories very well about where we have success and are sort of insular. And I think that this is the time for us to really show what our challenges are transparently, but then also show where we've seen improvement. I mean, I think one example, I love this example, is we have 39 jurisdictions reporting complete data on vaccine administration. It's happened in about a month and a half. How long did that take in COVID? Months and months. And so I think that that's the kind of that though frustration is real, and I would love to snap my fingers and have a outbreak move a lot faster. But I think we're seeing a trajectory that would say resourcing public health and the things that support public health mean results. And so this really is an example of where we need to sort of toot our horn, but also say we have real challenges. Like, we don't have an answer for some of the questions about uninsured people. We don't have an answer of how to replenish the SNS. We need the fiscal support to be able to do it.
The question of data, of course, and access, bi-directional access by CDC to state and local jurisdictions around the country, this has been a vexing issue. Dr. Walensky, director of CDC, her announced program of reform of CDC, addressing this as one of the top line challenges. It's part of, we have a working group at CDC, at CSIS, that's just launched on CDC reform. It's the first item out of the box. You've mentioned a little bit about you're making some progress with jurisdictions reporting, but this has not been easy. What are the lessons learned in terms of how to get voluntary compliance so that quality data is shared fast in a trusting fashion between the state and local jurisdictions and CDC, which this was one of the big stumbles in this case, and it was a stumble earlier too.
At the core, the relationship between CDC and the jurisdictions need to be such that information flows rapidly. And that, I think, is, again, I don't have the golden ticket to answer the question, but I can tell you that that is such an emphasis of what the CDC sort of look introspective look at itself and in its future is focusing on. That plus the work that's happening in the Data Modernization Initiative, the DMI Initiative, which will potentially make it even facilitate data transmission in a more rapid fashion. I mean, I think that, you know, working in local governmental public health and then also now working on the federal level, this is, I think, the question that of the most importance, which is looking at how data can flow so we can actually see what's happening on the ground, so we can address the inequities that are inevitable in our country that, you know, I think has baked into it things that automatically create inequities. So again, none of the inequities in COVID were surprising to people that do HIV. None of the inequities in monkeypox are surprising to me either. And so really seeing them fast becomes really important in formulating a plan, because you have to like have some information to be able to move forward.
Dimitri, let's talk about the fatigue and exhaustion that providers and public health authorities have been experiencing. Is there any hope that you can turn this around or help turn this around?
I'm a pretty optimistic guy. I think that this is one of the reasons that sort of thinking about things like the CR and thinking about forward planning is so important, because I think that we can. And I think it's really about identifying where resource gaps are so that we can fill them. But also, as the incident commander for COVID in New York City, what I used to say is, and I think that it holds true now, is that we really talk about trauma-informed care for our patients. We talk about trauma-informed care for our providers too. People have been through a lot, and I think it's important to both acknowledge it while also making sure that they have the resources to be able to execute the work that needs to be done. It's not enough to say, do it. It's enough. It needs to sort of have that voice of, we know what's happened and we know what you've been through and we know what your challenges are. So how can we work with those challenges to make it happen? And I think you're seeing that in the monkeypox response, sort of hearing about, we want to use our HIV SCD resources to do this. And so we figured it out. And so I think that that's like the kind of thing that really gets us to a place that local public health becomes confident in federal public health, that we're listening and giving them the resources they need to move forward.
Are they starting to feel that, do you believe?
I feel like there has been a net increase in optimism in my conversations with the jurisdictions around this. The whole team is working to make that happen, but I do feel that folks are feeling better now that we've sort of addressed scarcity of vaccine and are thinking, you know, asking them to think creatively and out of the box for how they can use the resources that they have in a way that actually lets them get the work done while we all work toward getting more resources with the supplement.
What is your thinking for the possibility of this becoming an endemic outbreak that cuts across human and animal species, which many people are commenting on? In the discussion around what are the core goals of the U.S. strategy, it's been a little fuzzy around, can we really contain and eradicate, or is this likely to become an endemic, in which case we need another strategy of how we deal with that?
I'm going to use my medium-term crystal ball, because my long-term crystal ball is not as good. But my medium-term crystal ball, I think what's going to happen here is that we're going to see the sort of epi curve of the outbreak go down. And I think what's going to happen is it's going to start to look, and this is completely conjecture, to look a little bit more like a monkeypox outbreak that's more familiar. With vaccinating the population that's at highest risk for this, I think we're going to see like more sporadic terminal chain type transmissions or small clusters, as opposed to this like big sort of tsunami wave that we saw with monkeypox. My crystal ball is not good enough to say like, will we still have these little clusters happen? But I also think my crystal ball is good to know that, you know, this is a global phenomenon and we really need to sort of focus on the rest of the globe to be able to make sure that we are addressing their health as well as our health. So I think that as long as we have sort of monkeypox circulating the way it's circulating, I think we're always going to have, or except for some amount of time, could have these sporadic cases, but I don't think we're going to see this giant hump again. It's my medium-term crystal ball.
So what is our contribution in Africa and elsewhere to the international response at this time?
This one I'm going to have to answer, watch the space, because what's exciting is that we have a global team that's been added to our work, working really closely with us as well as with NSC. And so I think they're really sorting through the issues of not only vaccine, but various other information and strategies like behavior change, et cetera, and how we can really interact on the global front. And so I think we have the right folks here who are having conversations. And I think it's a watch this space, because we're committed to really focusing on working with WHO and working sort of globally to address monkeypox outbreak, not just, you know, and not just focus on our domestic view.
I would hope that we'll see some this figure in the President's Africa Summit in December.
My crystal ball is not that good. But I think it's good. I think that based on what I'm hearing, I think that the conversations are moving where I think you'll hear things before December.
Yeah, no, I realize it's still early days. They've only sketched out sort of what happens on which day, yeah. And filling in the specifics is still a challenge there.
Dimitri, you've been incredibly generous with your crystal ball today. So
Midterm crystal ball. I haven't taken out the long-term one yet.
Right, so we have to be conscious of the distinction between the midterm and the long one. But if you were going to look at the long one, what gives you the most optimism going forward?
What gives me the most optimism is the community. Just seeing different data sources saying that people listen and they've learned about monkeypox and they've changed what they're doing and they're getting vaccine just demonstrates that this community is, you know, exemplary. They listen to public health, they connect to science, and, you know, it's our responsibility as public health to make sure that we do right by them. And so I think that's what I'm the most optimistic about, that we have like the community of humans who are dealing with this and the community of advocates that are making it happen and our colleagues across government that really have a commitment to the health of LGBTQAI plus folks, as well as the rest of the country.
Terrific. Thank you so much for your time today and for your service to our country.
Very generous and terrific conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Coronavirus Crisis Update is produced by Liz Pulver. You can find our full catalog of podcasts, including Pandemic Planet and AIDS Existential Moment, on our homepage at csis.org/podcasts.